You're listening to Podcaster Practice, brought to you by Springer Healthcare IME. Podcaster Practice brings you expert-led independent medical education discussions, inspiring healthcare professionals to maximize their learning and make measurable changes in their own clinical practice. You're listening to Podcaster Practice, brought to you by Springer Healthcare IME. Podcaster Practice brings you expert-led independent medical education discussions, inspiring healthcare professionals to maximize their learning and make measurable changes in their own clinical practice.
It was interesting that all sessions about new treatments were attended very well, and they do reflect all the hype, hope, skepticism, maybe even temerity of the field. In this session, should lecanemab be extended beyond 18 months, people started from the fact that actually there is only one phase 3 study about lecanemab, and there's another one from donanemab, and that actually both were done for the purpose of the FDA approval process. But both of them also give an opportunity for an sort of extended trial of or extended treatment of patients who have finished the 18-month trial. Particularly, lecanemab was also analyzed very rigorously with a lot of criticism as well. So the questions were asked like, what does it mean, 0.45 improvement in CDR box of sums? What does it mean, improvement in secondary outcomes? There's lots of questions about adverse effects, which may not be so small. And then, of course, there is this fact that only a few hundred people up to now were included in these trials. So all this is important when we consider the question whether to extend the use of lecanemab beyond 18 months. We heard opinion and experience from Sweden, where Dorota would argue for yes. She reminded us, of course, that we have patients who are on lecanemab in the US and also in Japan, and Europe will start with lecanemab very soon. And the question is, what should we do if they do well on the lecanemab? Should we, at the end of 18 months, should only the clinical judgment lead us to whether they should continue the treatment or not? We would certainly love to have some more evidence about what is good, what is bad, what to expect. She also reminded us that adverse effect in this trial was focused actually on the very beginning of the trial, and later on patients were a bit safer. And then, of course, she also pointed out that such studies, such data, enable us to set up the real-life registries, which will be of great help for us for further treatment and management of these patients. She gave a very nice example of how in Sweden, in Karolinska, they are preparing teams, clinical teams, which will deal with the new treatment, also with the planning about resources for follow-ups, and doing on a real-life register for these patients. They also made a very a nice online dementia course for educating people. And of course, there are, the literature is coming. I'm referring to the recent Cummings article about how the use recommendations for lecanemab. But of course, there were also critical voices. Some of them came from Lon Schneider from California, and he presented us the experience with his first patients, but also discussed on more methodological issues. He particularly discussed so-called forward, so the concept of forward or backward projections, which actually transforms the clinical outcome mean differences into the saved time or cumulative benefit. He argued that although such concept may be easy to understand and attractive, it does not tell us a lot. It certainly violates, as he put it, the analytical rigor of randomized studies. And he asked, what does it mean to say that, for example, 0.45 improvement in CDR is equivalent to 5 to 9 month time saving? Such a statement hinges on certain assumptions, like there are no missing data, or that the data are missing completely randomly, and that the decline in both arms is just the same in the observable observed period. It may be that using this forward and backward projections and concept of time saving is comparing incomparable things. And it may only actually be a mathematical magic of transposing the value from the y-axis, you know, which is clinical outcome, like CDR box of some, a sum of boxes in the case of lecanemab, into the x-axis, into the time. Of course, it may sound more attractive, more meaningful, but actually it does not change the fact that this change is 0.45, which many people would argue is clinically sort of meaningless, and some would offer another numbers like 0.9, for example, and would also argue that, for example, 27% of improvement, if you rely only on the source data, on the raw clinical data, would maybe mean only 9%. Of improvement. So the discussion was very nice. We had about 100 unsuccessful trials in the last 22 years to treat Alzheimer's disease. So I certainly were very excited when the first anti-amyloids were appearing on the stage. I think they are opening a new door, that new light is coming into the tunnel of Alzheimer's disease. Perhaps not so much in what they offer now and in the strict statistical and methodological analyses of the outcome measures they are offering, but I see them particularly important as opening new vistas and relying on different pathophysiology, which today is focused on amyloid. Tomorrow it will be also focused on tau. So I think we are on the horizon of a new hope now.
Thank you for listening to Podcast to Practice, brought to you by Springer Healthcare IME. For more information on our educational programs available, visit ime.springerhealthcare.com.